Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. In my talk, I will tell you something about an initiative that we started in Germany in establishing a network of terrestrial environmental observatories and the way we handle or the approach we have in making data available. And what I will do is I will first give a slight motivation why we are setting up these observatories, what are the costs involved in setting them up, and then I will tell you something about how we share data. I didn't really do a kind of an economic analysis in terms of costs and data sharing, so going to merely point out what the issues are. So what was the motivation for having this network of terrestrial environmental observatories? Basically the global change. And we all know that we anticipate about 9 billion people to live on this earth by 2050. And that this, of course, has an impact on the terrestrial compartments, soil, water, air, and vegetation. We also know that in the past we have dramatically changed the land surface. About 40% of the land has been changed, and half of that has been degraded. We have a lot in biodiversity. We have issues with water quality and water quantity, and of course, a lot of ecosystem functions. And in this case, also in Germany, we have effects of climate change on our terrestrial systems, and you see here four of the five areas where we show that our terrestrial system is sensitive to climate change. For instance, floodings, droughts, loss of snow cover in the Alpine region, which has, of course, economic implications. And in 2008, we decided to start up this network of four observatories with the aim of long-term monitoring of the different compartments, so basically groundwater, soil, vegetation, and air. And we received a budget from the federal government about 20 million euros, but just for instrumentation. So that basically means that the operation of this facility, of this large-scale facility, needs to be covered by staff that is on the payroll of the federal government, basically in the national labs. So these four observatories are operated by four national labs in Germany. And the idea of establishing Terrina was basically to bring together scientists from different scientific communities who typically would not work together, try to integrate disciplines, and also to exploit the availability of novel technologies and also develop technologies and using high-performance computing for terrestrial research. Typically, environmental research is based on short-term projects. What we try to do in this activity is to put a platform that is able, or to develop a platform that is able to provide long-term, high-quality data. Of course, we are not only observing, we are also doing experimentations in these observatories, and typically for the German situation is that we foster synergies between the national labs and universities, something that's most likely the same issue in the United States. I think in Germany we are a bit further progressed in this field, so that we have common facilities also between universities and national labs. The idea is, just to tell you a bit about the data that we are collecting, is that we have a multi-scale and multi-compartment monitoring concept, so we are measuring states and fluxes in all parts of the terrestrial system, so that is in the groundwater, that is in the soil, the land surface, vegetation, and the atmosphere. So we use different types of facilities, from wearable isometer systems to wireless sensor networks to airborne platforms and spaceborne platforms. This is some of the infrastructure that we have built up. We have a network of soil moisture systems and of eddy covariance. Eddy covariance basically measures the evaporation of the evapotranspiration of the land surface. It can also measure CO2, it measures methane. And what we developed here is a network that provides these data in 10 minutes intervals, so at a high frequency, and this now for the last 5 years. And what we try to do is we try to make these data available to the science community. Just an example of cosmic ray soil moisture network. It's also being established in the United States. It basically measures soil moisture at an interval of half an hour, and it gives you an average soil water content of the source of the soil, ranging between 0.115 meters and 0.7, with a radius of about 200 meters. We combine this with wireless sensing, and in the wireless sensing, we have you see the yellow dots, and at these yellow dots, we measure tree depth, so moisture content, and every 10 minutes. We combine this with continuously measurements of exchange gases of water and CO2 and methane at the Etiflux towers. We also have soil isometer systems where we take undisturbed monoliths, and we have in that case developed a system of 140 isometers across Germany, and one of them is installed at this catchment, and it measures all the fluxes in the soil system, including the states and also the outflow, and it weighs the system continuously. Just an example of what is being produced, we have about more than 30 million of these measurements, increasing every minute that I stand here and talk about it. And you can see what we can do with it. So you get spatial temporal information about the change of water content in these catchment systems. The blue is the wetter part in the river, the red is the uphill region where it gets then drier, and you get this information continuously. Yeah, this is the information we extract from that. You can plot mean water contents versus the variance of the water content, so you can see where the largest variation is of water content. You can plot that in dependence of depth. You can look at the impact of groundwater on soil moisture content. We can use different types of statistical techniques to analyze these results and to look at different patterns that occur, and to see what controls the change between wet and dry states in catchments. You can see here that here's a change. Well, if you use this analysis, you can see that at the turning point here around zero, that this is the critical moisture content, that this corresponds to the maximum variability that we observe, and this is only made able because we have this continuously measurement of soil moisture data. If you do not do that, you do not get this information. So continuous monitoring of state variables is very important to improve our understanding of the behavior of, for instance, catchments and hydrological processes. This corresponds very nicely. You look at the same water content, a shift in the slope between the runoff, so the wetter it gets, then of a certain moment the rate of runoff increases much more as compared to the rate below this critical value. And we use mathematical models to improve our understanding and try to figure out why this is a critical soil water content. We have also established within Germany a lysimeter network of 140 weighable, fully automated lysimeter systems. And the nice thing of this system is that they have been translocated from one region to another region, then basically simulating climate change, because we are translocating them from, let's say, from wetter regions to drier regions, or from regions where we have a decrease in temperature. And then these systems are automatically monitored, and then they provide us data to look at the effects of changed boundary conditions on the behavior of soils and the effect on transport processes in the soil. The system, this Torino, this terrestrial network of environmental observatories, is also part of a European activity called ICOS. ICOS is basically the Carbon Observation System. And this is a huge project. It's about 300 million euros, in which member states of the European Union are involved in a long-term commitment, so more than 30 years, to provide data on carbon exchange and the carbon dynamics in different ecosystems. And some of our sites of Torino are part of this initiative. And here there is the requirement to provide all the data to one center, which is located in Italy. And this center does all the data processing needed to interpret ethical variance data. And then these data are made available to the research community. So this is quite a huge effort, and there is one center specifically addressing the issue of data processing and data quality. And there must be about 10 to 20 researchers working at that site, not only for the German measurements, but for all of Europe. At the same time, we established critical zone observatories. Not sure whether you are aware, but in the United States, they are also operating critical zone observatories funded by the National Science Foundation. And we tried to link up with people working here in CZOs in the United States to come up also with a network and also exchange data among the network and within the network. We are not only doing observation, but we are deliberately changing the system. And what you see here is this area here, this red area, the red circumvented area. There we removed the existing forest, which was basically spruce, stemming from Prussian times, to support the mining activity. Natural vegetation is beech. So the National Park Authority decided to remove this part of the forest. And we are now looking at the long-term effects of what this change causes to the soil plant atmosphere system. And we do have a collection of soil data every year and look at the changes. And the next step, and this is also related to data exchange, is that we integrate these activities, critical zone observatories, terrestrial environmental observatories, and also long-term ecological research sites in a program called LTER, which has been submitted to the European Commission with a funding of about 300 million euro to have this platform of observatories that then also provide data to the science community in a long-term perspective. This is combined with remote sensing activities. Then in specifically in our case, we look at soil moisture. There is a lot of data being produced by satellite platforms like SMOS or the NASA satellite SMAP, which was launched in January, which basically measures soil moisture. And we try to connect this then to ground-based data to validate some of the algorithms, using also airborne campaigns to test the methodology. And we combine this with mathematical models. And the idea basically is, how can I predict a system? And what we do is, we use a model that describes all the processes in the system, and we have observations. And what we try to do is, we try to match the model predictions and the observations in an optimal manner. It's basically a statistical approach called Kalman filtering, where you are able to correct your model predictions based on what you are observing. This is typically what is done in weather prediction. If you look at the weather forecast, you see that they become uncertain the farther days are away from us. Same approach here. And what we try to do is to predict the hydrological and energy fluxes, but also the biogeochemical fluxes, so the CO2 fluxes, at the level of the field scale. So we can downscale this approach up to 100 by 100 meters. So the data is always a big issue. What we try to do is we provide the data free to the science community. So we developed a data portal called Theodore, and this allows also access to each of the sensors that has been that is presently running and provides data. And we have online stations like runoff stations and the sensor networks I've shown, the climate stations, cosmic ray, and each observatory has a known weather radar that provides data to the science community. And the way we do this is that we have a distributed data infrastructure. So this data portal, what we provide, does not have a known database. Every observatory is responsible for managing their own data, and we can use, let's say, data information technology to make it possible that you can get access through the data portal to the data bank of the specific observatory. So, and data quality needs to be assured by those people that are collecting the data. So, key message is, this is a distributed facility. This is not one database. This is a network of databases. So you can just go to this data portal, click one of the observatories, and then you can click some of the sensors, and you can immediately download the data just by asking for it, by sending, giving your email, just the purpose, and you can get the data directly. So what we try to do here is, as I said, based on the the available sensors. It's like you can see it as like Amazon. You just say, I want this sensor, this sensor, this sensor. You put it in your shopping basket, you give your email, and you get the data automatically sent to you. The data include metadata, so all the information that is needed to interpret the data, the person who measured it, the type of sensor, the numbers of calibrations that have been done, and then of course then the data. This is only possible for, let's say, smaller data sets. If you want to download 30 million observations of soil moisture, that will not go by email, so you will need to contact any responsible scientist to get them the data. Something that is important is that we work with persistent data identifiers, DOE. So that means that we try to ease the access to research data by making them publishable in a sense that they can be referred to. So, and there is an activity ongoing within Germany that 20 of these stations are now identified by DOE and then are also citable and accessible. And this is something that we are pushing for all of the measurements that we are doing in the framework of monitoring. So download statistics, you can see that data are downloaded from people everywhere around the globus. Of course we have a focus in the region where the research center is located, where I'm working, so that's near to Bonn, so we have a very intensive collaboration with the university. But you can also see that we have downloads coming from United States, from Wisconsin Madison, University of Michigan, who are also downloading the data. And you can see the numbers, typically it's about, we have had now about 2,500 downloads, the number of time series and the number of data that have been downloaded. As I said, there is an online data portal, so you can just go to the different sites. So these are the four big circles here, and then you just zoom in there and you can then select the information you want to have. This is technology that we developed and that is based on OGC, that is Open Geospatial Consortium, which is implemented in a web environment. So it is possible to visualize and access these time series, and you can select them, you can look at the whole time series, you can download them, you can do that for multiple sites, and you can do that for all the parameters that are being measured in a monitoring mode. So we have a data policy, and the data policy basically organizes the availability of data within the consortium but also outside of the consortium. And our policy is to make all data available, to be timely. Of course we need to protect researchers' intellectual property rights, it's important, and also the right to publish their results. We provide rules for the use of data within the consortium but also by third parties. And then, of course, we, as I said, as I've shown, we try to provide an easy access to the above data. Important is the data quality. We do not provide online the raw data. So you can only get access to the raw data by contacting the person who is responsible for that. So the data that are made available need to be quality flagged. And this is a big issue because the quality flagging is based on visual inspection. So that means if you look at the 30 million data of soil moisture, the time series, they need to be visually inspected before they are released, which is time-consuming. It takes a lot of time of the technical staff to take care of that. And we make a distinction between level one. These are the raw data. They are unevaluated. And then we have the level two, which is basically data that are quality controlled. We make a distinction between A and B, but it's not so important. And then the level three are the data that are derived from one or more level two data series. So the person for the quality flagging is the person that is that has collected the data, and these persons also perform the quality assessment. So the data levels, as I said, level one is the level one was the raw data, which is restricted. These are the basic monitoring data. Level two and level three are freely available. We do have project data, which are only available after a specific retention time. This is mainly to assure that PhD students have the opportunity to publish their data before they are being shared. And then the third party data that's of course restricted, and this is only then upon contact with the responsible scientists. The long-term vision is of course that we have these multi-scale observations. What we want to do is to predict terrestrial processes, and we need of course a data management visualization combined with modeling and data simulation to make let's say these predictions. And this can only be done of course if we also have a good data management and makes data available. Now just a bit to the costs. So the 20 million euro is just equipment. There is no staff included in that. So that means that the national labs who are operating these facilities are responsible for the staffing. So that means if you look at one observatory that produces all these data, it's about, I don't know, 15 to 20 people that need to take care of of getting the data, measuring the data, interpreting the data, and then making them available. And so in the end, and this is a bit of a typical approach in Germany, that the federal government tends to give easily money for equipment, but less for staffing and maintaining the equipment. And this is a problem that we are dealing with, is that of course we collect a huge number of data, but this is not in proportion to the staff that is available to do the quality flagging and to make them available. So, and even we are a national lab, so we are in the comfortable situation of having core funding. We are not obliged to obtain basically for this kind of activity third party money, yet we are in a difficult position because also we are being evaluated. And this also means that if you have heavy instrumentation, it binds a lot of human resources, which in the end do not publish or do not have time to publish enough. And then we get these evaluations from people that then come from other organizations. We then just look at the number of publications, but often do forget that preparing the data and making the data available is of course also a valuable effort, but which is not necessarily evaluated in the system. So I think also there needs to be a mentality change. In Germany we have it now that there is a requirement for all projects to make their data available. This is the responsibility of the researcher, so at least to provide the metadata, but also to make sure that data do not get lost. And there are special programs by the National Science Foundation in Germany to support this effort. And so with this, I want to conclude. Thank you for your attention. I hope I at least get, let's say, a part of the title covered and met your expectations. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We
do have time for questions. Do we have any questions?
Do you have a sense of how much of your budget goes to hosting the data in terms of physical storage and making it available versus processing and man hours?
Well, the physical storage is not the big deal. I mean, buying terabytes of capacity to store data is not the expensive part of it. The expensive part of it is, first of all, for our observatory, we have two people for the data management. And one person takes care of the development of the whole network so that people can access the data through the data portal to all the sites. The main resources we need is to maintain the systems, to analyze the data if they are not automatically measured. And that means you need lab facilities to do so, you need staff to do so. So in the end, as I said, if I look at the observatory that we are operating, I need to invest about 20 people taking care of this one observatory and making sure that data are made available. And this is basically I do not include the build-up of the facility. This is done, this is now running, up and running. It is mainly maintaining it, and there is a huge load in data quality control. And if you look at the numbers, we are dealing with 100 million of data, and so people need to flag these data. We are reluctant to use automated filters. We could do that. You could automatically filter your data. Still, there are still issues with the quality of the data, even if you run these automated filter systems. So I'm not sure whether that answered your question.
So what proportion of your data ends up being flagged?
Ends up unflagged or flagged?
Flagged.
Well, I mean, in the beginning, let's say the percentage of flagged to unflagged was 20% flagged, 80% unflagged. And now we are in a situation that for the measurements that I've shown, that we are about 80% flagged and 20% unflagged, except for one platform that is the lysimeter system, where we are behind schedule, where the flagging is about 5%. So, but these data do not amount to such a huge number of data as compared to the automated systems that we are operating. Unflagged is raw data. Nobody looked at the data. You just get the data from the sensor, they run into your computer system, and you store them. Flagged means you assign flags: doubtable quality, high quality, good quality. And this is done by a person. The person looks at the screen and says this time series is of good quality. And then it's tagged, and he looks the next part of the time series. And he goes through all the time series. And that is flagged.
Okay, and what would be a category of, I look at the data and this is bad quality, how do you call that?
That's bad quality and it's still flagged.
And how much of your flagged data is bad data?
That's hard to tell. I mean, I can't tell that. I mean, there are so many data, I don't know. No idea how much is, the difficulty is, if you're working with remotely operated systems, you basically need people who understand how the system functions. Because if you have, for instance, stream flow measurements, so you have a stream and it comes out of the forest, and you have a gauging station, and this gauging station is blocked due to leaves or whatever, you get jumps in your measurements. Now, if you do not know what is happening, you have a difficulty in deciding which flag qualifier you're going to put there. Is it bad data? Is it unreliable? Is it sensor due? So, or due to the sensing system? So this is the difficult part of it. And basically, the best flaggers are those who collect the data. And that also means, in terms with us, it's typically a technician is spending one day during the week with flagging the data that he measured. That's a rough estimate.
That's all the time we have for questions. Now, Dr. Morgan, I very much appreciate the presentation.
Thank you.